Brand has been the Global Director of Arts for the last 4 years at the British Council. He's already bringing new vision and energy around the world, and it's great to have him here. Please welcome Graham Sheffield.
Good afternoon, everybody. And it's really great to be back. Mary Lou was kind enough to ask me to do something 3 years ago, and I thought that was it, but she decided that I had to come back. I'm very happy to be back in New Haven anyway. Last time I was with you here was 3 years ago, and I shared some of my thoughts with you on the diplomacy of culture, and not quite the same thing, the culture of diplomacy. The first really concerns how culture can be an active player in international relations from the artistic perspective. The second, on how governments and foreign services use culture as a projection of a national identity to win friends and influence, sometimes without very much subtlety. I included as an example our diplomatic and cultural journey with Russia. The council had been thrown out. I've got a few slides to keep you sort of awake there in the background. This is a typical good slide from the sort of Cold War years. It's an exhibition of Bond memorabilia that we ran when I was at the Barbican. The council had been thrown out of Russia in 2007, and the UK's relationship with Putin's government was absolutely stone cold. But in 2011 and 12, largely led by artistic initiatives, a statue of Gagarin outside our office, an impressive Anthony Gormley show in St. Petersburg, the bilateral dialogue came to life, capped by an agreement to mount an elaborate UK-Russia season in 2014, of which this was a part, complete with programme boards, sponsors, international corporations, and tons of diplomatic paraphernalia. Then came the Crimean invasion, Ukraine, international sanctions, right at the start of that year. Now, it says much for the underlying mission of the British Council, working in the UK's national interest, but at arm's length in government, that we were able to continue the year at all. The artistic events went ahead, but stripped of any official attendance and receptions. Now, it goes right to the heart of our original mission. The British Council, founded in 1934, to create, quote, a friendly knowledge and understanding between the people of the UK and the wider world. Now, our mission is much the same today. Our work teaching English, sharing the UK's arts and culture, and developing educational collaborations, this all makes a lasting difference to our international standing and to prosperity and security, both at home and abroad. In this case, however distasteful it might seem, and however individual artists might feel, and some of them did decide not to participate, a position which I entirely respect, it's clearly in the longer-term broad interests of the UK and Russian peoples to continue some kind of dialogue through arts and culture. Now, a lot else has changed in these last 3 years, not just in Russia. Instability and intolerance are on the rise everywhere. Migrant and displaced populations in North Africa and the Middle East continue to grow on an epic scale, in part because of the seemingly never-ending Syrian tragedy. IS and its nihilistic interpretation of Islam have led to the widespread destruction of cultural heritage in the Middle East. All in all, not a pretty picture. Concurrently, American influence has declined in key geopolitical theatres as Chinese influence has grown, something maybe to reflect on. How have we responded, and how are artists responding? In the British Council, we've rapidly expanded our work in the field of culture and peacebuilding. This is a profound piece of repositioning for us alongside our more traditional showcasing work for the UK. We believe that arts can play a much bigger and more impactful role on the world stage in the field of international development, alongside more traditional military and aid-based interventions. We believe artists offer hope, memory, reaffirmation of identity, can strengthen families, and offer routes to employment and security. Culture reduces intolerance and builds understanding. This programme has two pillars. Artists in recovery. For example, we're supporting displaced Syrian artists to produce work. An exhibition that started in London travelled this month to the European Parliament and will come to Washington later via Belfast in Northern Ireland. and Voices and Space for Social Change. This last one includes access to justice programs through theatre in Myanmar, programs for at-risk youth in the Caribbean through physical theatre, creative collaborations in the Middle East and North Africa, for example, breakdancing and storytelling with young people in Tunisia. There you can see that. And that's breaking out now across the whole of the Maghreb region. It's a project we're helping to support and lead. Plus, arts in public space in the Americas and creative enterprise development in Afghanistan. Now, it's become a bit of a mission for me personally. I don't think the arts can be relegated to the sidelines anymore, or more importantly, be ignored by governments and key international agencies. Our evidential impact is too strong. Now, inevitably, this kind of work takes us into more directly political areas, controversial areas. But the arts have always been political. To me, Shakespeare was political. Beethoven's disowning of Napoleon in his Heroic Symphony was political. The wicked satirical cartoons of the 18th and 19th centuries were political. David's Death of Marat was political. Goya's The 3rd of May, 1808, or The Horrors of War were political. Picasso's Guernica. And their greatness as art is tied to the specificity of the conflicts and situations they portray. These are direct, these are personal, and I've just made sure I've left some papers that I needed. I don't have, so anyway, never mind. These are direct, these are personal, these are dangerous. I've just been reading a book called Art as Therapy, by the English philosopher Alain de Botton, and he comments about art having always been political, but the fact that it can be used in a corrupt way, and it can be used for good and for change. He cites particularly the Christo wrapping of the Reichstag soon after the Berlin Wall came down as enabling Germany really to think its conflicted political past. Now, I don't think I can recall a time when I've seen the arts so directly in the front line of global politics as now, with the possible exception of Stalin's terror and the artists like Shostakovich, who coped somehow, and so many who didn't, and disappeared. Earlier this year, we witnessed the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris. A month ago, one of our key partners in Karachi, Sabine Mehmood, a human rights activist and leader of a local arts centre, was gunned down and killed. And here in the US, we've seen Artists for Justice demonstrations at the Armory, raising the political temperature through art, and widespread protests at Art Basel in Miami last December. In Russia, Vladimir Putin is busy locking up artists like Pussy Riot, curbing social freedoms, and trying to re-establish a kind of insidious, old-style nationalist cultural credo. Even in this febrile situation, Neil McGregor of the British Museum felt able to lend the Elgin marbles, already hotly contested, to a Russian museum, a highly dramatic artistic gesture with deep political implications. In this talk, I'm trying to offer some kind of oversight on the current relationship between two uneasy bedfellows, artists and politicians, and some ideas for future positioning on what I've described as the hotly contested cultural relations matrix. Arts and artists are in the front line, in the social front line, as they seek to advance issues of personal freedoms, regeneration, social equality, the environment, and the power of these arts in these arenas have been notably expanded through the impact of the web and social media. I mentioned just now the senseless murder of an arts partner of ours in Karachi, Paul Smith, who's there in front of you, our current director in the United States and our moderator, was formerly our director in Kabul, Afghanistan, and over there oversaw some outstanding arts work in extraordinary challenging circumstances before and after our office was bombed, as you can see here, in 2012. We're still working there, but under even more constrained circumstances. The program itself is not political, but the fact that we are doing it at all is. We're working on creative enterprise development in a partnership with an NGO called Turquoise Mountain, supporting the development of creative craft skills as well as women's empowerment. And this is clearly seen as threatening by political and sectarian opponents of the government. The Charlie Hebdo affair in Paris is more complex, since it does raise issues of whether artistic freedom of expression is an absolute value or a relative one. The whole affair, quite apart from the inexcusable barbarity of the action, speaks much about the fierce secularism of French civil society and its belief in the absolutism of freedom of expression. Others might argue that a certain measure of respect and restraint in satirical portrayal of a religion might be more astute. Now, all religions have been satirized for centuries, but I can't help but feel now that in the pursuit of a common ground, some common ground of mutual understanding, a certain degree of self-restraint might serve us all better at the moment. And interestingly enough, I finished the Alain de Botton book yesterday on the train up from New York, and he mounts a spirited defense of a kind of organizational censorship that we might self-impose on ourselves. And he obviously wrote before these recent events. And he recognises it's probably an unpopular position to take, but interesting that he is actually arguing a case for it. Other artists are also on the front line. Take the instance case of installation and performance artist Tania Bruguera in Cuba. We hear a great deal about social change in Cuba, but this clearly hasn't extended to her. Her work pivots around issues of power, control, interrogating, representing events in Cuban history. A recent piece called Yo También Exijo, I Also Demand, was both performance and protest in the heart of Havana and led to her detention 3 times by authorities last December. I think she's now free, but waiting to see if charges will be brought against her. I think they've taken the passport away. A rather different case arose from the Edinburgh International Festival last year when the South African company Third World Bun Fight, directed by the very talented Brett Bailey, who worked several times with me at the Barbican, produced an extraordinary piece called Exhibit B. It was a unique hybrid of performance and exhibition, looking at themes of racism and Europe's colonial history by a set of 13 fixed installations with live people. It was based around the human zoos and ethnographic displays popularized not so long ago at the end of the 19th century. In each tableau, the audience is confronted by a black performer who casts an unsettling silent gaze at the viewer. I found it totally compelling. The reviews use words like moving, vital, disturbing, unbearable, essential. Not only as a political statement relating to the past, but also as a bold and compelling piece of theatre. What made me even more uncomfortable and sad was that when it was due to come to the Barbican after Edinburgh, it was actually forced off the stage by protesters calling it a, quote, act of complicit racism, despite the fact that all the cast who were black fully understood the implications of what they were doing. First, they were 100% wrong, the protesters. But second, they had absolutely no right to prevent other adults from seeing it, judging it, and responding to it. And I wish it had been possible for the Barbican's management to be as resolute as the programmers had been bold in standing up for fine theatre, provocative theatre, but in no way racist theatre. Some of what I've said already indicates that I believe there's been a much broader and higher level of social engagement by artists in recent years. It's difficult to prove causality, but it's hard not to see this as a response to increased intolerance in certain societies, as well as a belief that the arts can mobilise more forces, more opinion, and effect significant social change. Now, my own views have changed pretty dramatically in the last few years. I started working over 35 years ago as a classical musician and music producer on BBC Radio 3. I was basically just trying to make nice programmes. I had little idea who was, if anyone was listening, or who might benefit from my supposed expertise. Now, nearly 40 years later, almost everything I and my team do at the British Council in the Arts is intended to have some impact on positive social change around the world, an impact on prosperity, security, on improving the lot of people in less fortunate circumstances than ourselves. It's been a long journey from playing Bach to this, but I think a journey that others in the arts and other artists have travelled or are travelling very rapidly. Now, I've always been an unequivocal advocate of the need for the fundamental integrity of the art in all this, integrity of the artist, putting excellence at the heart of the work. But these days, I just don't think it's enough. We have to make a difference, whether in leadership or in actual artistic practice. And there's an increasing recognition of the power and benefits of the arts in social policy, even if it doesn't mean directly more or indeed any public investment when you talk about the state. Brazil has some very enlightened policies in deploying the arts in egalitarian ways. And for example, we've been working closely in Brazil over the last 4 years on many projects, and we'll be partners in an opera project for the homeless in Rio in 2016, based on a similar project which took place in the London Cultural Olympiad in 2012. And in Japan and Korea, there's huge interest in building on the work the UK sector has done and is developing in areas of arts for the deaf and disabled and in arts for an ageing society, both significant issues in East Asia. And we know only too vividly how attitudes to women and women's roles in society is challenging in India, with the multiple horrific stories of rape we've seen in the media not so long ago. This play, Nirbhaya, by the South African director Yael Farber, was intended as a direct response to this and proved to be a profound success at the Edinburgh Festival in 2013. Now, we subsequently helped it to tour India and elsewhere, and I think it's recently been in the States, hasn't it? Oh, yeah. Building programmes of debates and workshops around its deeply troubling subject matter. Arts and disability, arts and ageing, arts and women's rights, arts and mental health, this is not the soft power of international arts diplomacy, but the hard impact of social intervention, change, attitudinal change, and, well, hard politics. The UK has deep interest in these areas and a growing amount of experience, but we can only share this with the rest of the world if politicians recognise this strength comes from continued, consistent public investment in the arts sector, probably not only through arts budgets, but through resources from education, health, social services, as well as international development. Of course, not much of this applies in the US, and that may be one of the topics that we return to later on. The UK government remains resolute, and actually applaud them for this, on the UK's commitment to 0.7% of our GDP being dedicated to overseas development aid. This political commitment does enable us to enlarge our work around prosperity and security through the arts in an increasing number of countries, and I see this as a major driving force for our British Council arts work in the next decade. One single factor which has propelled the arts into the political front line more than any other is, I believe, the advent of social media in the last few years. Just in terms of reaching more people through our arts work, it's changed the whole way of working. Live Twitter tours of our art exhibitions, digital engagement on Facebook, digital commissions, and the possibility for artists to harness hitherto unimaginable numbers of people around arts and social issues. That's why the Chinese government spent so much time and effort trying to close all these channels down. I've mentioned last year we displayed work from our Artist in Recovery programme in an exhibition called Syria Third Space. It seeks to demonstrate the role artists play in supporting resilience and recovery, the artist as storyteller, the artist as citizen journalist. We launched a digital commissioning programme on the back of this project, and the digital reach was extraordinary. And through this work, we've built relationships with artists, and in the case of Iran, have paved the way, we hope, for the restarting of a sensible political cultural dialogue between our two countries. Our digital arts work in areas of social freedoms has included this Five Films for Freedom programme to extend the reach of the Flair LGBT Film Festival by making five of the films available for free screening around the world. The accompanying social media programme to promote freedom, equality and LGBT rights reached 137 countries, of which 43 continue to criminalise homosexuality. Colleagues in more than 70 countries at the British Council promoted the campaign. We had 5 million unique web impressions with the films, and interviews having over 250,000 views, 154,000 on the British Council Facebook site. This scale of penetration through the arts on such key social issues would have been unimaginable even 5 years ago. Now, of all the art forms, theatre is the one that most directly addresses politics. Politics, of apparently was once described as show business for ugly people. But there's, you know what I mean. But if there is an element of political theatre in the political process, then politics, at least in the UK, is an indispensable part of theatre. Two writers and critics, Michael Billington and Charlotte Higgins, both from The Guardian, have recently written fascinating pieces about the rebirth of political theatre and the continuing evolution of the political debate on our stages. Billington points to the recent schedules as evidence. Mike Bartlett's Charles III, the Donmar Warehouse's new play about the 2011 Occupy movement, National Theatre Wales' Border Game, a participatory event recreating the hazards of illegal border crossings. Many other examples put our society under the microscope and speak truth to power. Charlotte Higgins, who's a consummate classicist, by the way, provides a fascinating view of the way theatre infused the political and social life of ancient Athens, juxtaposed with a brilliant take on our own House of Commons as theatre, which is worth quoting. Quote, "It is a largely male cast. Raked seating flanks a thrust stage, and from time to time people leap up from the rows of benches to shout out their lines as if they are audience and actors both. There appear to be two protagonists. They quarrel noisily with one another. All of this carries on over a steady background of noise, exaggerated laughter, hoots and honks, cries and shrieks expressive of agreement or disagreement or derision or spite. It is compelling as ritual. The debating chamber of the House of Commons is a theatre. And since the television of proceedings in 1989, it has had at least potentially the whole nation as its audience. We may find ourselves cynical at the yelling and point scoring, more panto or pub brawl than Shakespeare. Nonetheless, it is people engaged in dialogue. It is debate, it is conflict, it is spoken, it is embodied. It is enfolded in ritual by virtue of the space it inhabits and by meticulous ordering of proceedings. Politics is theatre. It is surely because politics and theatre share so many qualities that of all the art forms reflecting back to us the world we live in, it is in theatre that it is theatre that is most adroitly and directly addressing its politics. The House of Commons is political theatre, but it's proved so much harder to engage our elected politicians in the real world of the arts, if that's not an oxymoron. No such issues with our House, our other chamber, the much more well-behaved House of Lords, who've been much exercised in the last year about issues of soft power. A House of Lords committee on soft power, followed by two debates on the subject, both of which offered strong support to the UK's two major soft power assets, the BBC and the British Council. In the second of the debates, no less than the Archbishop of Canterbury, it's always good to have God on your side, he stated, quote, "We need to demonstrate how it is possible to operate internationally in a way that increases understanding and hence reduces the likelihood of armed conflict, while maintaining a generosity of spirit that enables those with whom we cooperate to maintain their autonomy, independence and self-respect." In recent weeks, the wanton destruction by ISIS of cultural heritage that belongs to the world takes this way beyond narrow politics into issues for the whole of humanity, where only a concerted international effort, setting aside political divides, is likely to have any chance of success. To make a point here, this is a very British Council corporate slide. It attempts to place the entirety of our work within the concepts of security, stability, prosperity, development, and influence and attraction. It's quite an interesting slide to look at for those who are students of the scene, and also to see how we try and work our work into that. It's partly also to help make a good case for what government funding we've got left to continue in the next public spending round. Now, evidence of the impact of the cultural sector more widely is more widely acknowledged than ever. Our former Secretary of State for Culture, Sajid Javid, affirmed that evidence in a much broader perspective recently, saying, quote, "Not so long ago, many parents would despair at the thought of their children working on stage or screen. You need to get a proper job, be a doctor or a lawyer. But today, the creative sector is big business, a serious career choice. It's worth more than £70 billion a year to the UK, more than £8 million an hour." Those who like that kind of statistic. He was only referring to the UK, but the point is valid for so many developed and fast-developing economies. The creative industries are growing faster than any other part of the UK economy, with businesses in the UK arts and culture industry generating gross value added of £5.9 billion per annum. No Treasury Minister anywhere should ignore these facts. This means politicians taking a much keener interest in the arts, even if some of them aren't smart enough to appreciate the vital interdependence of the subsidised and commercial sector. Don't forget Warhorse started life at the National Theatre. So too, Les Miserables. Politicians in general seem more comfortable trumpeting the virtues of the so-called creative industries because they are seen as businesses, rather than arguing for at least maintenance of grant levels for the subsidised arts, which in their own way provide just as much engine fuel to the economy, and without which much of the sector's success would dissipate rapidly. Journalist John Kampfner, in a recent article in The Guardian, warns against the danger of the UK losing its international leadership role in culture if the government doesn't support it up enough, and other governments are supporting it more, as well as learning so much of how we do it in the UK. I know because my team sent many excellent professional colleagues from the UK overseas to do just that. Kampfner says we're in danger of throwing our success away just as other nations are embracing the arts and creative industries. If we don't invest in our public arts and creative education, the talent pool that has projected us to the top in the last 20 years will simply dry up. This is a highly political stance. This increased interest in the arts from governments is not just confined to the UK. China, Brazil, India, Georgia, Qatar, and more all have big artistic ambition. Each has its own rationale, political, social, economic, educational. But for all their individual motivations, each has at least spotted the potential. China's perhaps the most interesting example. An overt acknowledgement in their latest 10-year economic plan that the arts and creative industries are one of the five pillars of growth. China has made a huge investment in the hardware of the arts, art centres, museums, concert halls, but believe fundamentally that culture is there to serve politics. John Tusa, in his recent book, A Pain in the Arts, refers to the yawning gap between the European and Chinese experience. Cultural policy dictated from the top down. Chinese officials open in their belief that the core of culture is to serve politics, with the additional statement that, quote, if artists follow government, they will not starve, end of quote. The instruction from the top couldn't be clearer. Be creative and make creative industries flourish. But the essence of creativity, freedom of expression and thought, is chillingly absent, like something from Orwell's 1984. Russia's probably the least changed. Its overwhelming state-dominated arts and culture scene has always been part of the fabric of everyday life. A heavily censored projection of power and influence, heavily controlled. And we're seeing an alarming rerun of the same script under Putin. Hardly surprising, the rock group Pussy Riot were obliged to turn themselves into icons of free expression by attacking some of Russia's institutions, including the church. So the swing goes both ways. Artists become more political, and politicians seek to politicise and control the art. As my example of our recent Syrian show, Third Space, demonstrates, the arts themselves can become overtly and politically powerful, which only goes to show why in repressive regimes they are so often so feared. What's different this time around in the arts and politics debate is the importance of the cultural sector in economic and social regeneration and growth. Russia's oil-dependent economy is broken, nor can Qatar's gas economy last indefinitely, nor ultimately will China's heavy manufacturing economy last unless each of them diversifies. Hence the interest in the arts and creative industries. Qatar is investing systemically in a knowledge-based economy founded on arts and humanities education for the next 20 years. The Indian government has also seen it coming and is moving creativity much higher up the international scale. Ironically, it's the UK which seems reticent to invest, for all our fine words. The political establishment still split on priorities in the core educational curriculum between STEM and STEAM. For those not in turn, whether the arts A should be included with science, technology, English, and maths. For me, it's a no-brainer. The upshot of all this is that the era in which the arts can exist in their own bubble is long gone. I don't regret it. But are there dangers? Yes. For as long as governments continue to pay the piper, to whatever extent in some countries, it's inevitable they will still want, to a greater or lesser extent, depending on the levels of freedom in the country concerned, to call the tune. And where does the US sit in all this debate on soft or smart power? In the country which invented the term, you have, with respect, no British Council-like mechanism to influence this area of public policy, and much, I know, to the regret of many people here, and including me. It is therefore incumbent on us all, when we, in working in the arts, to guard our independence when we're working with politics, but also to take certain other protective, proactive measures. I offer you five to finish. Vigorously defend editorial freedoms, at the same time using them to build mutual trust and respect. Embrace social impacts, but not at the expense of the quality of your art. Embrace alignment with national as opposed to party political strategies in international policy and development. Look for ways to find support and resource from other budgets, other than the arts, education, health, science, environment, international development. The arts must become more broadly an attractor of public as well as private and corporate funds. And finally, articulate with confidence and evidence the benefits, the impact, and the value of whichever country you are a citizen. With all these multiple caveats, I would welcome the day when ministries of culture are at the heart of government rather than peripheral, still small, but highly influential and powerful across the full spectrum of public policy. Thank you.
The only rule this evening is that you have to go and stand by the microphone over there because this all needs to be recorded for posterity. That's great. If I can kick off, I mean, Graham has really given us there an extraordinary exposition of how the arts can no longer and should no longer be relegated to the sidelines, as you put it, anywhere in the world, nationally or internationally. And it struck me that that even 15, 20 years ago, if we'd been sitting here with to debate the subject of arts and politics, it would probably have been predicated on the fact that arts is essentially a marginal or a recherche aspect in relation to the big world of politics, and that we would be trying to fight for the possible meaning of arts in relation to political and international and global challenge. And it strikes me that one of the major things that has happened in this new millennium over the past 15 years is that the positions have shifted, that politics is now almost a subset of culture, of which the arts, of course, is the most evident moment of assertion. Really, since, as a classical iconic date of 9/11, we realised that so many of the issues in the world, so many of the geopolitical tensions in the world, so many of the crises of the world are actually culturally cause. They are about who is included, who is excluded, who belongs, who is the other, questions of religion, question of what do we value, what don't we value, questions above all of identity, questions of homelands, who belongs culturally in my home and who doesn't. So if culture is, you know, has become increasingly the deep waves under the surface froth of politics, and if culture is part of, is causing critical issues, that presumably culture, its manifestation in the arts, maybe should be part of the ways to seek solution. Antonio, if I could start with you. I mean, clearly working with Penn, you are working at the interface of art, particularly literature and politics all the time. Presumably Penn's primary concern is freedom of expression and the capacity for arts to navigate what they believe is happening politically in the world without constraint. I wonder in that respect if you'd like to reflect on Graham's talk.
Sure. I mean, I think the thing that struck me is that, just a little bit of background on Penn is Penn was founded in 1921 as a direct response to World War I. And it was founded as supposedly as a union or a nation, a united nation of letters. I mean, the whole idea was that art and literature and the artists could go beyond the boundaries of nation states, of political ideas, to kind of ferment change and cultural understanding through art and literature. And it's grown over the last 90 years to become something that's much more, I think, valuable and prominent than that. And right now, what Penn does, we advocate on behalf of writers around the world, defending free expression, but we also celebrate and promote literature, the free and open exchange of ideas. And I think at the core of Penn's mission is the defense of free expression. And when I say the defense of free expression, I don't mean the right for one writer to write something and to say what they want to say, whether or not it's objectionable. I mean, for a writer or a playwright to write something, for something to create a piece of art, for it to be experienced by other people. So it's not just the act of creation, it's the act of experiencing art as a mutual exchange of ideas and a free and open exchange of ideas. And so, you know, what Graham was talking about, what the British Council does, and especially working for a nonprofit in the United States, where we don't have a British Council, it completely baffles me that we don't have something of that equivalency. And I know, you know, looking back at what Penn has done and what nonprofits have done and human rights advocacy groups have done in the past, at one point they were funded by, or supposedly funded by, the CIA in the 1950s and 60s, which was somewhat disastrous. I mean, the Paris Review was funded by the CIA. Penn received some funding by the CIA unintentionally through another shell corporation. But it's one of those things where if we're actually going to do exercise soft power, we should at least make sure the boundaries between, you know, what we're doing and government funding is there, so that it's not considered to be a political, you know, a direct political arm of the government. I mean, as far as like post 9/11, I was talking to somebody earlier about this. I think what happened after 9/11 is that, you know, Penn definitely became much more politicized, and I think the intersection of literature and politics became much more accentuated, especially as America began to turn off from other cultures. We have a miserable translation rate. Only 3% of books that come in to the United States or that are sold in the United States are actually translated, or 3% of books are actually translations. And that's including like manuals. So it's nonfiction, you know, whatever it is. And so literary translation is pretty dismal. But, you know, our response was to try and facilitate the exchange of ideas. And so we founded the Penn World Voices Festival in 2004 with Salman Rushdie at the helm. We've started a couple of programs looking at how we could break down barriers of cultural exchange and politics around the world. And it's, you know, a lot has happened since then. I don't know if that's really answered the question, but I feel like there's still a lot more to be done. And I think, you know, the Charlie Hebdo, and I'm sure we'll touch on this later, I think that we've reached a new kind of zenith where we're looking at the responsibility of artists and the role that art plays in politics. And I think it's not so much free expression anymore, it's the different levels of free expression, the different levels of privilege and framing that go along with free expression. Somebody, you know, from a certain socioeconomic background who's white and privileged does not share the same, you know, standpoint and position of privilege for free expression as an immigrant of Islamic background. I think that's something that's very valuable that needs to be addressed, and I think will probably come to the forefront, you know, in this conversation, but also as we, you know, in American politics and moving forward.
Thanks, Antonio. I'm sure we'll come back to some of those points. I'd like to bring Athar in with you and to share with us some of your journey with the Extraordinary Sphinx Foundation and competition. Clearly, I assume your take on arts and politics comes from the position of having to try to achieve some kind of social change, recognise the needs of those who are politically and socially dispossessed in their capacity to express their creativity in the arts and so on. You probably see probably see the kind of things being spoken about here very much from the point of view of an urban social diversity and demography in the United States. What's your experience that you'd like to bring to this?
Sure. And hearing some of Graham's brilliant presentation too, it made me recognize very much the hybrid type of an approach and outlook I have on a lot of these issues. I come from, I was a child raised during the Soviet era in a small country of Azerbaijan, just north of Iran, one of the 15 Soviet socialist republics. So in my own experience, the arts being as strictly and deliberately censored as they were as I was growing up, and then coming into this country and seeing the arts and culture as very much a vehicle for expression, where that's almost taken for granted, and where the arts can be such a powerful force and have such a reciprocal relationship with the people that the arts are intended to serve. And then ironically, I end up finding my path from being a classical trained violinist into the very intersection of arts and social justice that I find with the Sphinx organization. So it's a remarkable kind of an opportunity to view the arts in such a morphing form, but then also recognizing that really the arts play the same role. It's just a matter of how much they're empowered to make a difference, to change, to empower, to engage. And through my work with the Sphinx organization, I really view Sphinx as very much a social change, social justice type of an organization where the arts are merely, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but really the arts are a vehicle for change. And that, at least that is the very passion and my attraction to Sphinx, and it was from its beginning, and that Sphinx was conceived to give voice to those who don't have one, where the voices are either not present or muted. And my direct work with Sphinx has very much touched on that in a very integral way, in that we live in a country where the arts are at such an incredibly sophisticated level, where there's such a plethora of offerings, and yet we have such a divide between the arts and the society that the arts very much hope to represent and serve. And that, for me, then deals with inclusion, that very issue of inclusion that Graham was raising. In our 800-some symphony orchestras in the country, we have two of our largest minority groups in the country, Blacks and Latinos, represented at approximately 4% combined. And the numbers are very, very similar in music schools and conservatories. So in other words, there's a really long way to travel in terms of our society level recognition of what the arts are. They are a vehicle for expression, they are a vehicle for empowerment, they are also a very direct educational mechanism, and yet we have such a dramatic underrepresentation. So a lot of the work that I do now very much daily deals with everyone from young people in elementary schools who just have absolutely nothing by way of the arts, where we are in elementary schools and public schools where we're having to infuse things both during and after school, to concert halls that struggle with the issue of inclusion and interest and engagement and diversity, where we're trying to bring in onto stage kind of the very best of the best, so that those who are in the audience can see themselves really being involved, see themselves as stakeholders. So it's very much a multifaceted process, and even though the arts from the nonprofit outlook are encouraged and almost mandated to separate ourselves from politics, it is in fact inseparable, in that there is that charge, both on a domestic and a global level. And for us, our artists do this work domestically on a national level, and when we go abroad, very much the charge is to reach out to and collaborate with communities that are most at risk of being radicalized. So it's a fascinating journey. I don't know that that answers fully your question, but it's something that I'm still exploring and trying to fully maximize through the prism of my work at Sphinx.
Interesting. And of course, the work of Sphinx is primarily in the art form of music, and is particularly concerned with literature. Mm-hmm. And Graham, you particularly felt that theatre is intuitively natural form to to deal with politics and polemic and so on. I'm just wondering whether, maybe you'd like to go on this, Antonio, whether we were sort of debating beforehand whether all significant and great art doesn't automatically have a political dimension to it in some respect. Any work of art is exploring where power and authority lies and moves and changes and so on. Are there some art forms which are always at the nexus of politics and polemic in a more obvious way than others? And the very fact that pen exists would seem to suggest that literature is constantly, because it uses the same medium as the politicians, is always up against it.
It's an interesting question. When I think about the work that pen does, I do feel that literature and written narrative and even in just oral tradition is very much a political act. And I think, when I think about what Penn does, and it goes back to this definition of why we define free expression is the fundamental building block upon which all other rights are based. So without the ability to comment on, to criticize, to discuss freely, you can't really have a civil society. You can't establish rules and regulations where you can have a participatory government, where you can have art and culture, where you can actually move things forward. And I think narrative plays a huge role in that. I mean, when I think about, the countries right now where we have the most writers in prison, we have 41 writers in prison on whose behalf we're advocating for in China. One of them is Nobel Peace Laureate Liu Xiaobo. When I think about